Well, just like your knees, a dog's knees are held together with ligaments. And when that ligament is injured, it can cause a lot of problems. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk back to answer your pet care questions. She's a clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. And we're going to start by talking about knee problems in dogs and taking care of your pets during hot weather. And, of course, we'll also take your calls. I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@WPR.org. or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, welcome back. Great to have you with us.
It is so nice to be here.
Tell us what happens when a dog ruptures a knee ligament.
Well, it's happened to one of my dogs, and he did it traumatically by jumping off of a dock and landing on some rocks. And that is not the typical way that it happens. Most of the time what we do is we'll see dogs, and most of them are overweight dogs. We know that dogs with that get cruciate injuries are usually, they get it at about four times the rate of slender dogs. So it's, obesity adds to it, but it's sometimes it involves the type of exercise you're doing with your dog where they're cutting and turning really fast, and they put a lot of stressors on those knees that could already be stressed by carrying some of that extra weight. But we also know there's probably some genetic component to it as well, because of the way certain dogs have their knees structured anatomically. And the reason why I thought this would be a great topic is because my own dog, who loves to chase the hose, I mean, if I take a hose out and I'm watering and have it spraying, he is out there jumping through the air. And this is a bulldog who is in actually pretty good physical shape. But boy, I see him cutting and turning, and I'm like, oh boy, I'm glad I've got pet insurance, because he could be a cruciate waiting to happen just because he is a bulldog. And they tend to have, in many cases, knees that are not the most stable.
Oh, and yeah. So diagnosing, you know, you look at the dog, you can probably tell.
Yeah, most of these dogs, it comes on acutely, where they're normal, and then all of a sudden they may yip or something, and then they're holding their leg up. Owners may say that they're toe-touching, meaning that they'll put their toes down and maybe bear a little bit of weight. But you can imagine these ligaments that hold the knee together, they're called cruciate ligaments, which means that they're ligaments that cross. And the one in dogs that is called the anterior cruciate or cranial cruciate, we tend to call them cranial cruciates in dogs rather than anterior like they do in people. If that one ruptures, now you've got instability in the knee. And so when they put their foot down and bear weight, the lower part of the leg slides forward. So that tibia slides forward, and you're going to end up tearing the meniscus, developing cartilage damage. It's very painful for the dog. And without treatment, they are going to have a knee that's going to develop some pretty severe arthritis.
Now, is it always surgery or what?
Unfortunately, yes. There are some companies that are making custom-made knee braces for dogs that obviously every dog's shaped a little bit differently, so it's not something you can go and buy over the shelf. But we've had some people say that it's bought their dog some time. And sometimes these are dogs that are elderly, where the owners don't want to invest in the surgery, or they've got some other health issues that make surgery not a good idea for them. And it might be something to try. But for long-term use, you're really looking at surgical repair.
And that's major surgery, really.
It is major surgery. It's not something that I would ever want to attempt. And there are several types of surgeries out there that can be done. Sometimes it's based on the size of the dog that's being that has had the injury. Other times it's based on the skill of the surgeon and what they feel comfortable with. And, you know, some have a little bit better results than others, but it's one of those things where don't be surprised if your veterinarian has diagnosed your dog with a cranial cruciate rupture that you may be referred to a surgeon to have it looked at and repaired.
Well, Ben in Minocqua has a question that goes right along with this, so let's go there. Ben, hi, thank you for calling.
Hey, Larry, thanks for having me on the show.
Sure.
Yeah, my black lab, Bo, blew out an ACL in the woods just on a normal run. went in for surgery, and then right after anesthesia, they put him in a holding pen to just go to the bathroom, and he found his way out of the holding pen, ran off, and then he bruised the other ACL.
Oh, my goodness.
Because of all his weight on the other leg.
Yeah, and that's the problem. Most dogs that rupture one cranial cruciate will, within a year, I think what the odds are is something like over 50% will rupture the other one within a year. So that just goes to show you that it's probably, you know, anatomical, but it may also be related to weight and things like that. So it's, unfortunate for your dog.
What could you suggest as, you know, helping with his quality life? Because he gets sore quickly, and maybe any food you can suggest?
Yeah, there's...
We're trying to stay away from the heavy medications.
Let's talk about the whole healing process.
Well, after the dog has had the surgery done, it's really important that you follow a strict rest regimen to allow everything to heal. Usually the day after surgery, we have our owners meet with our physical therapist to be able to get started on some form of physical therapy. And they have to be walked with a sling and, you know, really kept quiet, which can be hard when you've got a really active dog. But for long-term use, things that you're looking at would be, number one, weight control, because we want to make sure that those joints aren't holding extra weight. And you'd be surprised how many people look at their dog and think that they're normal, but they're actually overweight. We should be able to see a waist. We should be able to feel ribs. And labs are definitely overrepresented for being the fatties of the dog world. Unfortunately, they love to eat. So weight control is one. You mentioned diet. There are some diets on the market that are referred to as joint diets. Hill's makes one, and Nestle Purina makes one. And they're a diet that are very high in fatty acids, in particular the fish oil type fatty acids, EPA, DHA, and those can be very helpful for some dogs. And they're also moderately calorie restricted to also help hold control weight. Fish oil by itself can be added as a supplement, but you need to use it at a much higher dose than you would consider using it for something like skin problems in dogs. And off the top of my head, I think it's like 100 milligrams per kilogram daily, which is seems like an awful lot. But we just kind of go with the closest fit that we can. And it can be fish oil that you can buy over the counter in human pharmacies. I buy it for my own dog who's arthritic, because he had bilateral elbow surgery done just at one of the big box stores, and he takes it down without any trouble. I open the jar, it smells like fish, but he seems to think it's pretty good stuff. So that would be something. I know that there are some people using things like a turmeric extract. I think it's called curcumin. Again, available over the counter. I don't know the exact dose off the top of my head, but those would be the kind of supplements that you'd want to be looking at. Then we start looking at anti-inflammatories, and many of these dogs, just to be able to function, need to be on some type of a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory. And that's, I think, what you were probably getting at is the big gun medications. And sometimes they just have to be used as needed. Other times they need to be given the dog to function on a daily basis. And when we have dogs that are going on this, we have to make sure that, one, they're healthy and can tolerate it. So we usually check liver values, kidney values, especially in older dogs. And then once they've been on it for 2, 3, 4 weeks, we get them back in and recheck some lab work to make sure that they're tolerating it. At least in my point of view, is I've seen more labs than any other breed have liver complications with this particular type of medication. So I'm always careful.
Yeah, that's why we're staying away from
that. Yeah, but I think it can be used safely, and it's rare, but it can happen. Mm-hmm. So as long as you follow your vet's instructions and do the appropriate monitoring, your dog should be able to be fine. And you have to give it with a meal. There are some that are given once a day. There's some that are given twice a day. Some of the medications are now available in a more generic type form, which saves a little bit of money than the brand name forms. The things that you want to avoid are aspirin, even using low-dose aspirin, a single dose of aspirin, when they've gone in at the appropriate dose for the dog and scoped them, if they found gastric ulcers in these dogs.
Wow.
They just don't tolerate aspirin. And Tylenol, absolutely, you have to be very careful with that. Although we do use a Tylenol and codeine mixture in dogs, we're using it for the codeine part of things if they can't tolerate pain medication in the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory group of drugs. So there's things like that that we can use. There's also another pain medication that we use that doesn't work on the joints. It doesn't take down inflammation, but it stops the dog from feeling the pain. It's called Tramadol, and it's it works centrally, and so it makes dogs feel more comfortable. And so as dogs get older and maybe can't, for certain health reasons, handle some of these drugs, there are other alternatives that we can use to make them feel better and give them better quality of life. But don't forget about long-term physical therapy. I mean,
yeah, that's what I was going to ask.
Yeah, physical therapy is going to probably be the thing that is going to give your dog the best outcome from surgery. You can have the best surgeon, but if you don't exercise this dog right and get them back into the swing of things the right way, they're going to end up having problems. So work with a physical therapist, get some good exercises. This time of the year when we've got water available, that is perfect. I wouldn't be recommending
a lot.
Yeah, I wouldn't be recommending, you know, running into the water and so on, but, you know, wading in and then maybe while he's buoyant, you know, throw something that you can he can bring back to you so he gets those legs moving. Very, very helpful if you can get you can do that. Obviously, in winter, we're a little limited, but there are places around the state that have dog pools that people take their dogs to so they can swim even in the middle of winter.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks a lot for calling. You know, just to follow up for a second on the fish oil, you mentioned the fish oil, but then you also mentioned a couple of dog foods that can
that have it in it, yes.
Yeah, would you still add additional fish oil?
That's the problem. Some of these diets, they just don't contain enough of the joint supplements that we would like to see used. So it really depends on the dog. Often the diet alone may provide enough of the fish oil, but the glucosamine, chondroitin sulfate, that type of thing, that's another supplement that you can use, tends to be at lower levels, and we still need to supplement with that.
All right. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest from the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Malik Anderson, our on-air producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 1 o'clock today, Kathleen Dunn will talk with a former gang member who is helping at-risk youth avoid prison. That's at 1 o'clock. Right now, taking a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Happy to have you along. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Or post a photo on our Facebook page, a question as well. But if you've got a pet photo, we'd love to see that as well. Title of our page, The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. Tom in Green Bay is up next. Tom, thanks for calling.
Thanks for having me. I have a question for you. My dog had her knee come out on her last April while hunting. And since then, it's come out once or twice again. And I brought her into the vet, and he said it's not a tear. So I put her on a regimen where she's been restricted in her running and walking, and basically I've had her swimming a lot, but that's been about it. And I'm just wondering, is there a certain time frame that I could look for to see if, you know, how long it would take for her to get this back in shape a little bit. It seems to be working. She hasn't had the issue now for about a month.
Okay. And I'm curious as to whether this is actually a ligament problem in the knee or whether she has something that we call a luxating or loose patella or kneecap. Do you know what the veterinarian had said? Because if it's her kneecap, that's a totally different story than ligament damage.
Nope, he took an x-ray, but and he said it wasn't a tear of the tendon. That's basically what he told me, so.
Yeah, it's very difficult to diagnose soft tissue injuries in the knee with just an x-ray.
Okay.
And so what we would be looking for on x-ray would be, you know, increased joint fluid, sometimes the positioning, the way the femur and the tibia sit together, arthritic changes to indicate whether there's some chronicity to the problem. But the kind of hallmark for getting a diagnosis of a cruciate is doing some testing, like something called an anterior drawer sign, which is a specific way of palpating the knee to see if it's loose, or okay. something called a tibial thrust, which is, again, one of those things that I can't really explain it over the radio. I'd be more than willing to show clients how to do it, but it's not the easiest thing to learn how to do. But that's the kind of things that we would do on physical exam to be able to diagnose whether that's a problem or not. I'm not sure how your veterinarian's looking at the x-rays and saying there is nothing going on there. And it may have been something like just a partial tear that with your rest and rehab has now allowed it to heal, and the dog's doing fine. But I would, you know, usually we're looking at a real strict change in lifestyle for at least 2 or 3 months, if not longer. It kind of depends on how they're doing, you know, and we wait until they get the clean bill of health from a surgeon to start back with moderate exercise and then getting back to full exercise. So it can be months before we have them back being their old selves again.
Okay, I appreciate that, and I will have to call my pet and ask for a little more information.
That sounds great.
That sounds wonderful. Thanks, Tom. Appreciate the call. Let's turn to Rick and Gaze Mills next with a question. Hi, Rick. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I have a 17-pound mutt who's about 5 years old. He's dark, and therefore his claws are black. It's a real chore to do a nail trim on him. It takes at least two people, one to really hold him, the other to trim. I wanted to ask if you had any recommendations about nail trim, number one or number two. Is it really even necessary to do? He does get some time in the city on concrete, which tends to wear down the nails a bit.
And that can happen. We see dogs that if they're exercising a lot, they'll just wear those nails down and they may not need to be trimmed. The problem is if they have dew claws, those are those extra toes that dogs have that are kind of like our thumb, because they don't contact the ground, they may need to be trimmed. We've actually seen some dogs where that nail is growing to the point where it's twirled around and is actually piercing the flesh of that toe and can be quite painful for the dog. Nail trimming, to tell a little story. I got invited for a group of first-year engineering students that had to come up with, their project was coming up with a foolproof nail trimmer that would not quick a dog. And it was because one of a big benefactor of the School of Engineering, who was visually impaired herself, had dachshunds that all had dark nails, and it was becoming cost prohibitive to take them to the vet or to the groomer to get the nails done. So she wanted something that she could do herself. Long story short, after they spent an entire semester trying to develop something, they realized it's impossible. That it takes, like when I'm trimming dark nails, I'll take little tiny cuts and just like take a little bit and have a look, take a little bit and have a look. And what you'll end up seeing before you get into the quick is it almost looks like looking at the end of your fingertip. It'll kind of bulge out at you. Once you've got kind of one nail trimmed, you kind of have an idea of where the rest of them have to be trimmed. There's lots of stuff online on how to do this. The thing that I have, we have issues with, though, is once a dog has had a bad experience, you've cut them too short, and it's made them scared, now it makes it more difficult for you. So I usually pull out things like baby food, peanut butter, and just get the dog used to handling their feet, maybe tapping a claw with a nail trimmer, and then maybe just doing a nail or two while they've got their mouth full of peanut butter and they're not going to be as aware of what you're doing. The other thing that I'll do, I have a dog at home that has monster claws. His name is Bruce, and he's a 10-year-old bulldog. huge nails that are really difficult even for me to be able to get those nail trimmers around and cut. And so I use a Dremel tool with a sanding disc on the end, one of those little, it looks like a little barrel with sandpaper on it. And I sand his nail, grind his nails and do exactly the same thing. Grind a little bit, have a look. Grind a little bit, have a look. He tolerates that much better than he does using nail trimmers. And I think sometimes the pressure that the nail trimmers produce can sometimes startle a dog or bother them. But again, if you're going to be introducing a grinder, there's some that are out there that are made commercially for dogs. There's one called the Petty Paw that I've not had really good success with because as soon as you apply any pressure to the nail, it stops the motor. So I usually jump right to using a Dremel, and I just have mine that's down in the shop that I use. But you can actually get online a Dremel dog nail tool that has the discs and so on. It runs on batteries. And that works quite well. We have one of those in the clinic and it gets used frequently. So that might be another way, again, desensitize your dog to the noise of it, the feel of it, by making it a pleasant experience. And hopefully after several attempts like this, you'll have it down and your dog will be happy and not mind having a pedicure done.
All right. There we go. Thanks a lot for calling. You can join in too at 1-800-642-1234. Shoot us a pet photo on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a question there as well. Love to hear from you. Tim in Chippewa Falls, your turn. Hi, Tim.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure thing.
I have a 10-year-old Welsh Terrier that had an accident where he caught one of his rear claws or toenails, and it got caught and almost yanked out completely. It was a bloody mess. And we wrapped his little paw in a wet towel and got him to the vet where he was sedated, and they plucked that claw out.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering how long it takes for it to grow back.
Weeks to months. Sometimes rear nails grow slower than front nails, kind of like our fingernails versus our toenails. You know, when you look at how often you have to trim, we'll see that in dogs as well. The problem's going to be watching as that nail grows in. If the nail bed itself, and it sounds like if it was that, you know, damaged where it was just hanging there, there may be significant damage to the nail-producing tissue. That nail that's going to be growing in may become pretty gnarly, like it could have ridges, it may be growing at a funny angle. It all really depends on what kind of damage was done, and you won't know that until you start seeing it growing in. In the meantime, it's important to make sure that it's kept protected. You may have to keep a little booty on your dog, keep it clean if they're outside, avoid, you know, walking in real rough areas like where it's like rocks, sand, that type of thing, so that bare nail is not going and touching anything. But it I've lost fingernails before, and I know it can take a long time to totally grow in. So just be patient. It will happen, but hopefully it'll grow in normally and not be a deformed nail.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. I had that happen with a toenail.
Oh.
And the nail came back really gnarly and weird. And that was a year and a half or so to kind of get that back into proper form.
I was at a wedding not too long ago, and my stepsister had lost one of her toenails. And she's a beautician and always has beautiful nails and beautiful toenails, everything perfect. What did she do? She painted the skin with nail polish right over it. And, you know, to be honest, it looked at a distance, didn't look that bad. But don't paint your dog's bone on the, you know, there, that little stub that's hanging out. You don't have to do that.
Josh in Madison up next. Josh, thanks for calling. Josh, are you there?
Is that Joan?
It's Joan.
Oh, Joan, I'm sorry. I misread the word. Sorry.
Yes, I'm calling. I have an 8-week golden retriever pup. She's 1/8 lab. Anyway, I want to know, I mean, a lot of jumping and biting, and, you know, how do you stop them from doing that? How often do you feed them and how much?
Oh, you have, like, my new puppy appointments are an hour long. Again, so I don't think we're going to have enough time to spend the next hour talking about puppy care, but this would be something that, number one, I would make sure that you get your puppy enrolled in puppy kindergarten, that a lot of those questions are going to be able to be answered for you. Going to your veterinarian, having those list of questions as well, is going to be very helpful. Often the veterinarian or the veterinary technician can answer a lot of them. But, you know, the big things are, like right now, would be potty training, how to have your dog go to know they have to go to the bathroom outside, and just realize that an eight-week-old dog can only be left in its crate for about 2 hours. So I usually say a month of age equals 1 hour of being able to be in the crate. So it means your life is going to be pretty controlled for a while, or you're going to have friends and neighbors that are going to be able to come over and help your dog to get them out. But kind of my rules of housebreaking are that 100% of your attention is on the dog. You don't watch TV, you don't cook, you don't go to the bathroom, you don't answer the phone, your eyes are on the dog. And if you can't have your eyes on the dog, put a leash on your puppy and hook it to your belt so that the dog is right in your vicinity. So as soon as they start making any behaviors that say, hey, I have to go to the bathroom, you can get them right outside. I like to see owners go outside with the dog, rain or shine, 24/7. You need to be out there. And remember, it's a business trip, so have the dog on a leash rather than having them loose in the yard, because dollar to donuts, you're going to have that puppy chasing a leaf or doing something and totally forgetting what the business trip was about. And then they come in and you go, oh, I guess you didn't have to go to the bathroom. And then they go on the floor. So you're out there with them in a confined area on a leash. And as soon as their fanny's coming up off the ground, you're going to get something absolutely wonderful in them. I wouldn't do that in the middle of the night. We don't want to turn it into a party in the middle of the night. But during the daytime, lots of treats and so on, as soon as they've gone to the bathroom. The mistakes I've seen people make are they don't watch the dog out in the backyard. The dog comes to the back door. They open the door. They give the dog a treat. The dog just got rewarded for coming in, not going to the bathroom outside. So it's a lot of work on your part. Not impossible. I've just been through it myself.
Yeah.
And we still, once in a while, if I'm not really careful, we may have the odd accident. But it's very, very few and far between. The jumping up, boy, that's something that is the dog needs to learn, that I have my fanny on the ground, I get attention. And so it may mean turning your back to the dog, doing, you know, like a little bit of a body slam if the dog's jumping on you. And that's something that is kind of 101 dog training when you take your dog to puppy kindergarten. And then biting and chewing on you, that's how puppies play. And I'm not saying that they need to bite on you, but you need to make sure that as soon as they make any effort to put their teeth on you, you've got something in your pocket that you can immediately put in their mouth that they can go and chew on. A toy, a rawhide stick, something, so that they are able to just, you know, you just keep redirecting to the right thing, and eventually they'll catch on that people are wimps. They don't like to get bit. Have something to chew on, and just be patient. You've got a baby, and you've got lots of weeks of being chewed on and having to clean up accidents ahead of you, but it's worth it in the end.
Good luck. Good luck, Joan. Appreciate your call. That's why sometimes it's kind of nice to be getting a dog to get a little older one.
I know. Well, the reason I've got this new puppy that came to me, and I had actually applied through a Chicago English Bulldog Rescue for an adult, and we passed all the tests and so on, and I get this phone call, we found the dog for you. And I'm like, well, which one is it? Don't keep me in suspense, because they're all online. And they're like, well, we don't post this one. He's a puppy. And I'm like,
oh.
Not what I was expecting, but it's so worth it once they get to that point of being well-behaved.
Kathy in Stratford, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi. I have kind of some follow-up questions for dogs that tear their ACL.
Yeah.
My dog tore her ACL. I left her out at night, and she came back in 15 minutes not wanting to put her foot on the ground. I live in the country, so I'm sure she saw a raccoon or a deer and tried to chase it. She had her surgery on the 12th of June and had her stitches out, and she's putting weight on it. But now the vet says that she will never be able to go without being on a leash. Because I live in the country, she might chase something. I have her with an electric fence that she, I mean, she has over 2 acres to roam on. But my question is that I'll never be able to let her off the leash. And I currently have her on Tramadol twice a day and Medcam once a day.
Okay.
And I'm wondering, you don't really see... I can't really tell when she's in pain and how I should, if I should cut down on some of those pain meds or, the vet said, well, you know, just start cutting down if she looks like she's okay. Well, I have trouble with that.
Yeah.
And the worst part is I live in an area, we have no dog physical therapists.
Okay.
Anywhere.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And this, I mean, that can be a problem. Definitely right now you are so close to that post-op period, your dog needs to be on a leash, not forever, but I'd say for the next couple of months, very restricted exercise, out to go potty, back in again. You can do a lot of passive range of motion exercises. You can, you know, if you've got, you know, anybody with a pool that you can get your dog into, that would be perfect for getting some exercise that way. Regarding your question on how do you tell if a dog's in pain, I get people all the time, the dog's coming in limping, and they're like, well, he's not in pain. And I'm like, well, he's limping. He's painful. He has to be painful. And so, you know, watching their gait, things like, are their pupils dilated? Do they stop panting when you touch a certain joint? Do their pupils dilate? Do they turn around and look at you when you are palpating a joint? There's sometimes very subtle signs. But if your dog is still behaving gingerly on that leg, then they are in pain. And I think the anti-inflammatories, especially the meloxicam, the once-a-day drug that you're using, should probably be continued a lot longer. The tramadol, you may be able to stop because that, you know, acute post-op pain is probably starting to fade, but I would definitely consider keeping them on the anti-inflammatory that you've got them on.
Yep. Okay. Yeah, she does turn around. She doesn't want me to touch her knee, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I try to manipulate it a little bit. I don't want to do the wrong thing, you know. She is putting weight on. She is scratching after she goes to the bathroom, you know, how they kind of mark their territory or whatever. And so, I mean, I think she's getting better, but... I didn't know how long she was going to have to be.
And you may have to travel. And I really think that it would be worthwhile to find a clinic that has a physical therapist on board. It may mean coming to Madison or traveling someplace. But you are, you know, it's worth it to set up an appointment like that so that you can learn how to do it appropriately so your dog has the best chance of healing. Just because you're out in the country doesn't mean you can't take your dog someplace. And I think that that's going to be probably the best thing for your dog.
There you go. Thanks a lot, Kathy, for calling.
All right. Thank you.
Sandra in Mount Pleasant, your turn now. Hi, Sandra.
Hi. I'm back to nail clipping, the dreaded nail clipping. I found a product that has a guard on it, and you can set it. And the suggestions on the package are... I use the safety stop to prevent trimming nails too short. And if the nails are very long, trim a small amount every 7 days or so until they get where they belong. And then you could do it monthly. And it's made by Alliance, it says on the package, out of Ohio. And I think I bought it at Farm and Fleet.
Yeah, whenever we get those in at the clinic, we take the guard off.
Oh, no.
Because it's useless, okay? Because you can still get into the quick. There is nothing miraculous about having like a little stopper thing on it. To give you an example, back a few years ago, there was a nail trimmer that was invented that had a red, green, and yellow light. It was battery powered, but you would still squeeze it. You would put the claw in, and as you would squeeze, if it was green, that meant it was safe, that there was no blood flow going through. Yellow was you're close, and red is definitely don't do it. So I took my baby finger, shoved it through the hole in this nail trimmer and squeezed it. And guess what it said? green. Go ahead, chop your finger off. So that's why we don't trust those things. It still comes down to skill and observation. And you're right, if you've got dogs with super, super long nails, doing a little bit frequently is easier on the dog than doing a lot of it all at once. And sometimes it may mean going to a groomer to get them done professionally and then you keeping up with either grinding them, filing them, or intermittent, you know, just shaving a little bit off the nail once in a while.
There we go. Thanks a lot, Sandra. Appreciate the call. Judith in Wausau up next. Hi, Judith.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Well, I hate to differ with everyone, but I have a question about cats. I'd like to know if Dr. Sawchuk could talk a little bit about the diagnosis and progression of oral small cell carcinoma in cats.
Huh.
And what usually, if there is any treatment, and I'm not sure that there is, what that might be.
Yeah, these are oral tumors in general. I'm going to just preface this by saying I am not an oncologist, and I greatly appreciate the fact that just around the corner from my service, we have our oncology staff, and they're able to answer questions like this for me. But oral tumors in general, especially if they are a malignant tumor, can be very difficult to treat. Sometimes you can go in, depending on where they are, and surgically debulk them. That sometimes will, you know, give them some time. They usually need to be staged, meaning that the regional lymph nodes in the area need to be aspirated to see if there's any evidence of cancer cells. May need to have an MRI or a CT scan done to look at the surrounding tissues to see what's up. Some of these animals can, I mean, there is radiation therapy, but boy, that's often a tough thing in an area like that. You get a lot of like burns and so on that sensitive mucous membranes. But in general, oral tumors in cats, because they groom themselves and they need to have full function of their mouth, they often don't do very well. So I would recommend, if you want a second opinion, is to visit, and we, not only at the vet school, but in other areas of the state, we have board-certified oncologists that would be able to evaluate. I would be recommending bringing in your biopsy results. Obviously, if you've got an answer, you've probably had this thing biopsied.
No.
Well, we don't know what it is then. Okay.
Well, that's kind of my reaction, but I've been told that was made without a biopsy.
Yeah, there's no way you can look at something and say that that's what it is. So
that's,
I would be strongly recommending you get a biopsy, primarily so that you can know life expectancy, things that you may be able to do and try to be able to give your cat good quality of life.
Yeah, because he's been put on Convenia once every 2 weeks because we had brought him in for a tooth extraction, which we thought was going to happen approximately 10 days ago, and got a call after the cat was anesthetized and examined that the tooth had just fallen into the vet's hand when she went for it, and that they had found a growth under his tongue and on above that tooth on the upper left jaw.
Yeah.
And we were simply told this is what it is, and it's very aggressive in cats. We were given Medicam, and as I said, he was given Convenia.
Yeah, but Convenia is a once every 2 weeks injectable antibiotic.
I've used it before.
Yeah, and Medicam is pain medication and anti-inflammatory, which you have to be very careful with using in cats. They're quite sensitive to it, and it can, if they've got any underlying kidney disease or anything like that, it would not be something that you would want to be using. But I it's just too bad. The cat was prepared and under anesthesia. Mm-hmm. They could have taken a little piece of this thing and had a look at it, but it means that your cat needs to be anesthetized again to be able to get a biopsy.
Good luck. Thank you so much for calling, Judith. Appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for being with us today on the Ideas Net as we take a look at your pet's health. with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Larry Mueller here. Join in with one open line at 1-800-642-1234. And let's turn to Dam in Partyville next. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. We've got a 12-year-old lab German Shepherd mix, and he's having a hard time just getting up off the floor and moving around. A friend of ours found this product that she gave her 13-year-old dog and worked miracles. And I was wondering what you thought, if you ever heard of this before.
What is it?
It's Overby Farm Hip Flex Joint Level with tart cherries.
Not sure what is actually all the active ingredients in it. But
There's glucosamine, methylsulfonylmethane.
Okay, MSN.
MSM, yep. Dark cherry and dark berry proprietary blend.
Okay.
Chondroitin.
Mm-hmm.
Vitamin C.
Mm-hmm.
Hyaluronic acid.
All right.
Linoleic acid, omega-3 from flaxseed, omega-6 from flaxseed, and vitamin E.
Yeah, so this is very common, except for the cherry bit, a common combination of things that we use that are joint supplements that, you know, are they going to help a dog that is already in pain? It may help improve the viscosity of the joint fluid and make them feel a little bit better, but it is, you know, I would be looking at that's probably not going to be enough for a dog that is showing the what your dog's showing. You know, we've been talking throughout the show about all the different things that we can use, but one of the things that I think we as veterinarians and even as owners make a mistake of, and I just did this, I'm going to admit, I'm just totally thinking that it was just arthritis in a dog, but I had this dog who was 12 years old, and it came in with the owners just saying, you know, just moving slower. And I'm like, well, she's 12 and probably has some joint pain and so on. Well, it turned out that she has immune-mediated polyarthritis, which means that it's kind of like rheumatoid arthritis for us. It's the immune system that is working on her joints and making her painful. There are other things, infectious things like Lyme disease that need to be ruled out. So, you know, don't just think I'm just going to give my dog medication, that it's old, that it's got arthritis, and that's going to be it. Make sure that you do get some diagnostics done, whether it's joint taps, x-rays, at least a visit with your veterinarian to try to figure things out rather than just making that assumption. I think when we've got a dog that is, it sounds like your dog's having so much trouble getting up, we sometimes have to change the environment as well, putting in non-slip carpets so that it's easier for them. They get some footing. There's some like little booties for dogs that are called pawsies, P-A-W-Z, that are, they look like balloons that go on their feet that just provide better traction if your dog would tolerate them. And again, that may be helpful. Looking into if your dog can tolerate it, the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories or some of the other medications that we'll use, we'll sometimes jump to things like gabapentin, amantadine. These are all prescription medications. There's a whole host of things that we can do depending on what the lab work shows us, the age of the dog, the severity of the dog's problem, and we'll often use these things in combination. So using this product that you've mentioned, I don't think it would be a problem at all. There's nothing in there that I would say would be unsafe for your dog, but it's probably not going to be enough to be able to solve your dog's issues and make them feel comfortable as they age.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, appreciate the call. Cindy in Wind Lake, your turn. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I was just calling in. We have an 8-year-old French Mastiff, and he has a severe problem with the thunderstorms, and they have a new medicine that's out called Cilio.
Yep.
Do you know anything about that?
Oh, I have firsthand experience with it because my old bulldog, Bruce, is terrified of thunderstorms. My other two dogs, they sleep through it, but he's up barking and just, you know, wanting to be with people. And so I took some home from work and said, well, I'm going to try it on my own dog. And it was one of the best things that's ever happened. I came in to work the next day, and normally after a night of storms, my colleagues, they see me dragging around because I've had no sleep,
right.
And they're like, oh, you're in a good mood today. And I'm like, I got sleep. I didn't have to worry about it. But it's a drug that is in a gel form that is given orally, and the active ingredient is called dexmedetomidine. We use that by injection for sedating dogs and doing things like that. But this had very little sedation effect on the patients, my own dog and other patients that I've used it in, because it's really fairly new on the market. What it does is it blocks a neurotransmitter called norepinephrine from being released, and that's the chemical in the brain that's involved with developing fear and anxiety. And so I'm a convert. I've got a brand new tube sitting at home. My dog, Bruce, I was able to get 3 doses out of the syringe. You having a French Mastiff, it's all based on weight and to, you know, how many, there's little dots on this syringe, and you turn a wheel and you give it orally. You don't want them to swallow it. You don't want to mix it with food. It's got to go in the cheek pouch so it goes absorbed through the cheek. But I've been very impressed with it. It's you don't get a lot of uses out of a syringe, but boy, oh boy, having that on hand, I think I will never be without it again. When do you give it? This is what's really interesting. Most of the time when we're using these any psychoactive drug, we have to give it before the storm starts. And that can be a problem if you're not at home or you weren't watching the weather. And so if you're giving things like a Valium-type drug or something like that, and the dogs will just override it, and it doesn't seem to do the trick. This, if we're fortunate enough that you can even give it when they're anxious. And so ideally you would give it before, but you can give it even if you've missed that point, you can give it at that point. And it seems to do the trick, because I just did that this weekend. So, yeah.
What is it called again?
Cileo. Cileo.
Cileo.
They're off, though, pretty fast, or...
It lasts for 2 or 3 hours. I've actually found that once my dog settled down, he went through the entire night with one dose.
Okay.
So the packaging will say, you know, you can repeat up to every 2 hours.
Yep.
And I had no necessity for doing it again, but he slept through the night with just the one dose.
Oh, good. Great.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Anne in Madison, thank you for waiting. Hello.
Hi. I just have a little question. So when a dog is outside and bathrooms outside, why do they then, like, scratch a couple times with their front paws, kind of like they're burying, but they're really not burying? Why do they do that?
Well, not all dogs do that, but when they do, I think it has something to do with dissipating their scent, leaving scratch marks, a visual cue, a scent, you know, with the scratch marks in the ground, but also they have scent glands in the pads of their feet, and they're leaving their scent behind. So they're not burying it like a cat. It's for a totally different reason. It's just for scent marking.
Oh, that's interesting. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks for calling. Vicki in Oregon, your turn. Hi, Vicki.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. The last 2 times we've taken our Labradoodle in to be groomed, he's ended up with issues on his backside. One time he ended up with infected anal glands, and I didn't think we even cleaned out his anal glands at that appointment. And the other time he ended up with almost like a razor burn, it seemed like, on his near his tail end. And I just was wondering if there's something. Yeah, I know he's kind of skittish about being groomed, and we've been trying to go with, you know, like force-free groomers and things.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything that we can do to help prevent him from having issues like that at future grooming appointments?
Yeah, I would definitely talk to the groomer about the fact that your dog has very sensitive skin. And, you know, when we do get clipper burn, it's just like if you were shaving your legs and you got, you know, the layer of skin off, it hurts, and they'll continue to lick at it and so on. But making sure that they're using maybe clipper blades that are a little bit longer, and they go by numbers as to, you know, how much hair they're going to be be taking away. The higher the number, the more hair is that it's taken away. I'd be making sure that your dog doesn't have any matting, because sometimes we have to, when we're grooming dogs that have hair mats that are adhered to the skin, we have to get right down there with the clipper blades to be able to get those mats off. So keeping up with the grooming between episodes is really important. Anal glands, I don't want, even though it's smelly and it's convenient to do by the groomer, I really don't want them doing the anal glands, because squeezing them externally can increase the pressure in the glands and cause inflammation and problems for the dog. The proper way to express anal glands, which groomers don't do, is rectally, and which is the way veterinarians and veterinary technicians would do it, putting a glove on and expressing them so that anatomically you're not adding extra pressure to the duct and causing problems. So making sure that you put right out there, I don't want his anal glands touched, leave them alone. And and then, you know, if there are any areas that you know are hypersensitive that don't have mats, asking them to maybe leave the hair a little bit longer in that area, if it's not going to make him look kind of goofy, if he's got an irregular hair coat, that may be necessary too.
All right.
Oh, all right, great. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Sandy sent a photo on our Facebook page. She's got a couple of dogs at a little swimming pool.
Yeah, I just bought a new one for my dogs because their old one sprung a leak. And boy, it's really helpful on these hot days to have a nice cool area that they can go in, not only get a drink, but lay down in and help get cooled off.
And you've made your own popsicle. We don't have time to talk about it.
But we can the next time. We'll talk about how I make my own popsicles.
We'll do that. Our guest today, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. She's going to be with us right up until 12:30 today, almost 12:30 anyway, and she will be answering your questions. Again, if you'd like to join in, post a photo on our Facebook page of your favorite pet and or pets, and we'd love to see it, and we'll share it online on the Facebook page. News is next. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network, taking a look at your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Great to have her along, and thanks again for listening. Join in. Our number, by the way, is 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. I want to go back to those popsicles.
Yes. Yeah. So my dogs love, there's commercially available little ice cream cups for dogs. And I just got tired of buying them. And so I thought, why don't I see if I can make them myself? And I actually found the recipe online, but just modified it slightly. So I take a large carton of fat-free, plain yogurt. I usually buy Greek yogurt just because it's a little thicker. A couple of ripe bananas and about a quarter of a cup to a little bit more of peanut butter, and whip that all up and dump it into paper cups, like just small, like the little bathroom cups.
Yeah.
And then I'll take a dog biscuit or a pepperoni or something and put it in like the stick and freeze it like that. Peel the paper off, and now I've got something I can hold, and the dogs are licking it. Now, my dogs don't have any issues with lactose intolerance, but if you have a dog that has lactose intolerance, you probably are not going to want to use yogurt. But, you know, very few dogs seem to have issues with that. And it's just that I feel like I'm giving them something special on a hot day. And when they have dog friends over, we have ice cream parties. And that works very well. And you can modify it different ways. Just you want to avoid any raisins, grapes, chocolate, kind of all those things.
Yeah.
And but they, you know, and I probably could leave the peanut butter out and, you know, they'd probably just eat the plain yogurt. But it makes me feel better that I'm using up some old bananas and things.
So a couple of bananas and
A carton of yogurt and a good sized scoop of peanut butter. And I just whip it all up and dump it into cups and freeze it with something. And you don't have to have a stick in it, but mine will just try to swallow it whole. So this way it gives me something to hold on to. And then when it gets small enough, boom, they get their cookie at the same time.
Well, what about, you know, I think Sandy's photo of the dogs with the little swimming pool is one great way to help dogs cool off in summertime. You know, when it's very hot and humid, it has a big impact on.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, we see heat stroke in dogs, and it can be devastating. And one of the things that if you think your dog is experiencing heat stroke, which would mean bright red gums, panting excessively, you know, pupils dilated, maybe being mentally not all there, potentially having some diarrhea. These are emergency cases and they need to be seen ASAP. But you can improve your dog's chance survival rate if you start external cooling at home. And by that I mean getting a wet towel and wrapping it around them, you know, putting their feet in some cool water. You know, we want to make sure we're starting to get that body cooled down. The problem I see is if people start overcooling their dog, we only want that temperature to drop to about 103.5, which is still in the fever range, but it's going to continue to drop, especially if the dog is wet. And now we're dealing with the opposite thing. We've got a dog that is now hypothermic, and it can be even harder to deal with. So start that external cooling and get them into the emergency room ASAP.
Carrie in New Glarus up next with a question. Hi, Carrie. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question regarding my 10-year-old rescued. He's part Chihuahua Pekingese dog, and it's actually a couple of questions. One has to deal with dog allergies. He's allergic. He has a wheat allergy and also seasonal allergies to the point where he has licked off, you know, he licks the fur off of his behind and his tail. Mm-hmm. And his ears will then, and then he gets, of course, a yeast outbreak. And his ears, you know, will then get infected because he's itching his ears. And, you know, so we usually deal with all that. But what is, like, the best way to handle allergies?
The number of things that we need to do, a couple of simple things that you can do. One would be to damp mop your dog when they're coming inside. After they've been outside, especially for outdoor allergens, grasses, pollens, molds, that type of thing, just take baby wipes, a damp washcloth or whatever, and wipe your dog down, and to help decrease the amount of stuff being brought in. Making sure that you're washing your pet's bedding at least weekly. A lot of people don't do that, and that can, again, be an area where they're sleeping and they're just constantly being exposed. But one of the things that's on the market and is now very readily available that is kind of like the miracle drug for treating dogs with allergic skin disease is a drug called Apoquil. And it works on the nerves, the nerves down at the itch area that keep it from feeding back to the brain to say that you're itchy. They stop traumatizing themselves, which will help stop getting those secondary infections. The drug itself will not stop the itch from infections. So you probably, if your dog has a secondary infection like yeast or bacteria, will also need to be treated. But that is something that we resort to frequently in these dogs. And it really has made life very much easier for everybody that have dogs with allergies. So talk to your veterinarian about getting this drug called Apoquil, Apoquel. It's been on the market for a number of years, but has been in very short supply. And now they've got all their production up and running, and you should have no problem at all getting it.
All right. Thanks, Carrie, and good luck. Sandy, on Facebook, Julie posted wondering if you'd comment on studies showing the correlation between early spay-neuter and hip and knee problems and also increased cancer risk. She has a female heeler springer, 4 years old, not overweight, but active with recovering from TPLO surgery.
Yeah. Well, this is an article that came out a couple of years ago, but there's been some studies coming out of UC Davis, and I think Georgia did a couple of them as well, where there's one where they looked at the medical records of 759 client-owned intact and neutered female and male dogs. And they were looking at dogs that were neutered, you know, prior to a year of age or were intact or neutered after a year of age. And they evaluated them for things like hip dysplasia, cranial cruciate ligament tear, lymphosarcoma, hemangiosarcoma, and mast cell tumors. And they said that of all five of those diseases, they were found to be significantly higher in the neutered dog population. So that's a small study, really, even though it was only looking at 700 and some odd pets. But it is one of those things where I talk to the owners about it. And, our concerns are we don't want the pet to develop sex-related behavior problems, roaming, fighting, leg lifting, those types of things that could happen and can be a problem to deal with. And so often we are forced to neuter them early to help with their behavior the behavior changes that go along with going through puberty and becoming a mature adult. We also look at the risk of not having birth control. And so if you are an irresponsible owner letting your dog roam, then you could be adding to the pet population. So we're, as a profession, kind of stuck in this place of should we, shouldn't we? And I've kind of broken it down into sizes of dogs. And I think that small breed dogs, definitely get them spayed or neutered early because they have fewer orthopedic diseases and so on. So get them spayed or neutered early. Large breed dogs, males, if you can wait until they're over a year of age, go for it. Females, it's a crapshoot because we have the issue with breast cancer when they come into heat that increases their risk of developing breast cancer. So we have to weigh out all of these things. So it's not cut and dry. I wish it was, but I think right now the majority of our population, a veterinary population, feels get them spayed or neutered early. But, if the owner is wanting to decrease the risk of some of these things, it's got to be done with caution because of the other things that could happen with behaviors and so on.
Let's turn to Stephanie in Pulaski next. Hi, Stephanie. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a year and a half old black lab mixed rescue, and he's a very submissive pup. He tends to be very skittish of men, including my husband, who has scolded him, and then he will just go pout on his bed. And he has gotten to the point now where he will even growl, not in a mean way, but just because he's scared of my husband and other male figures that come to visit. Do you have any advice?
Yeah.
Number one, you need to work with an applied animal behaviorist. These can be really tough cases to work with. Number two, there is no nice growl, okay? That growl could very easily turn into a bite. And so that sends a big chill up my spine when we've got a dog that's that fearful that they have to resort to that level. So things that you could try at home before you start working with a behaviorist. Number one would be having your husband be more involved with the dog's care. And by that, I mean he needs to talk quietly, maybe squat down, not look at the dog, toss treats towards the dog, no scolding or anything like that that could, trigger this dog to become more fearful. Have him be involved with feeding the dog, it's dinner, and maybe walking the dog, so he can become the major caretaker. And it's that's dealing with just one person, obviously, the one that's there all the time. When it comes to having visitors over, that's a tough one. You almost have to have your dog out of the room, have the visitors prepped ahead of time with little bags of luscious dog treats, chopped up hot dogs, lunch meat, whatever it may be, have them be in the house, sitting down, knowing that they're not going to look at the dog, they're not going to reach for the dog, they're going to keep their voices very quiet, potentially talking baby talk if they can, and then you can bring the dog in on a leash while they toss little bits of food to them. And again, what you're doing is desensitizing your dog to the presence of men. And eventually you're going to change things a little bit as the dog's comfortable with them sitting. Maybe then they'll one of them will stand very slowly and then again continue to toss treats. But it's a very slow, gradual process. And the worst thing that you can do when you have a dog that's fearful is punish them for being fearful, because they're just going to jump to the next level. You know, running and hiding didn't work. Now I have to growl. Growling doesn't work. Now I have to bite to send the boogeyman away. So you need help. And he's a young dog. And so getting help ASAP, I think, is going to be your dog's best bet.
Good luck. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Louisa in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Louisa.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just had kind of a follow-up question to, I believe it was called Chilio, a drug that you were talking about a little earlier, mm-hmm. which she were you were talking about specifically for use with thunderstorms and anxiety caused by that. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering what other applications it may have, and if it's something we could consider for our pug with travel anxiety, who flips out anytime we have to put her in the car for any reason.
I would not be using it for that. It's not labeled for that. It is labeled only for noise phobias. If you have a dog that is terrified of being in the car, I'd be looking at other anti-anxiety drugs. There's one that we use frequently called trazodone that you may want to consider trying. Any of the benzodiazepines, Valium, Xanax, and so on. Obviously, these are prescription products that you may need to use. I've had some success with dogs with mild anxieties, with some of the kind of supplement-type medications. There's one that's called Soliquin that the Nutramax company makes that has been very helpful. It's basically a milk protein-type material that for some reason makes dogs feel more comfortable and relaxed. But those would be the path I would be taking to be able to see how your dog does. But I wouldn't be recommending using Celio. It's quite specific for noise phobias.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. And Elizabeth in Janesville, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi there. Thanks for letting me on the air.
Sure thing.
I have a kitty. He's a three-year-old kitty. He was a stray that we adopted. He's a big orange and white one named Bruce. And Bruce has been having a history of seizures for about the last year. And the funny thing is about the seizures is that they only come about every 8 weeks. And each seizure that he has is getting longer and worse than the one before. He had one early Sunday morning, and it was like somebody was taking a taser to him.
Aww.
And, you know, it lasted about 5 minutes, and then when it stopped for about 10 minutes afterward, you know, he would have twitching of his limbs. His eyes were severely dilated, and then it took about 2 or 3 hours for him to, like, really settle down. And my vet is really mystified as to, you know, why they're only coming every 8 weeks. And he is going in next week for a booster shot and an exam, but I was just wondering what Dr. Sandy thought of it.
Yeah, seizures that are left uncontrolled will typically do this. They will gradually become more frequent and more severe over time. When I think of cats being epileptic, the things that I worry about are infectious causes, brain tumors. He's kind of young for that. Prior trauma could be doing it. Or it could just be epilepsy, where it's, you know, at the chemical level down in the brain that, you know, some type of an inherited type problem. One of the things that I'd want you to consider thinking about would be getting him going on some anticonvulsant drugs.
There's... Yeah, my doctor did mention phenobarbital, and mm-hmm. when we bring Bruce in, probably going to be Monday or Tuesday when we bring him in, we are going to discuss phenobarbital about getting him on that.
Yeah, and that can, you know, sometimes make them a little wiggy, but a lot of cats will tolerate it fairly well. There is a feline seizure control study going on at the veterinary school right now. If you were to call the vet school, they would put you in touch with the neurology department and they can explain it all to you. Unfortunately, I don't know the whole thing, what's included, the, you know, the, whether there's lab work or, you know, medication or whatever. But if you have a cat that is having seizures, that is something that you may want to look into. And you're not that far away from the vet school because I live in Janesville and I make that commute every day. So
yeah,
if the vet school,
no, we're not that far.
Yeah. And that may be something that you'd want to consider. The vet school's number is 608-263-7600, and you can just say, hey, I've got a cat that may be eligible for the cat seizure study, and they'll put you through to the neurology department.
I think I'll do that. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks so much. And what's the number again? 608?
608-263-7600.
There we go. Thanks again, Elizabeth, for calling. Oh, we have a nice photo up here from Holly. She says, Schultzy, the Palm, loves boat rides up north. And look at the big smile on Schultzy's.
Oh, my goodness. But you know what I'm not seeing is a personal protective flotation device. Yes, they do make them for dogs. And you're out way far in the middle of the lake. And if suddenly a wave hit, that dog's standing on the side. But that's the vet in me coming out. You know, seeing this dog, I'm like, oh, my goodness, if he fell in, are they going to be able to get him? So think about getting a life jacket for your dog.
Kelly in Green Bay, hello.
Hi, thank you. I was wondering, I just wanted to get your guest's opinion on plasma sciatic pododermatitis.
Plasma cell, okay. Pododermatitis, yes, okay.
I had brought my cat to the vet for cracked, swollen, discolored paws, and that's what the vet theorized he had.
Mm-hmm.
Now, before I had brought him in, I started him on a salmon oil regimen with his food because I had read that it could also be an omega-3 deficiency. Now, it's been about 2 months, and I'm starting to see some improvement. However, the vet told me that this is most likely a virus condition and that changing his diet won't necessarily help.
Yeah, I'm not aware of it being a virus type problem, but they usually do respond to steroid treatment. And so usually we'll put them on prednisolone, something like that, to be able to get this under control. You can do a biopsy to be able to get a definitive diagnosis, but often just the appearance of the feet is enough for us to say that's what it is. So I'd be looking into talking to your veterinarian about going on a steroid treatment to see if we can get those feet feeling more comfortable.
All right.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for calling. And Pat in Whitehall, thanks for calling.
My dog, Charlie, he's a full-size collie. For the last 3 months, he's been having a swipe of blood on the side of his feces. And I have taken him to the vet, and they weren't too concerned because it was a brighter colored blood. I wondered what you
thought.
Yeah. When we see frank blood in the stool, that means that it's coming from the large bowel or the colon area. If they're bleeding up higher in the intestinal tract, the blood gets digested and the stool would look black and tarry. But the fact that you're seeing this streak of blood on the surface of the stool, I'm really worried about a large bowel mass or something, a polyp that is getting irritated as the stool is going through. I think your dog probably should have a good rectal exam as well as potentially having some endoscopy done where they go up and have a look, like a colonoscopy is done to people, which means he has to be emptied out just like we do, and they can go up and have a look around and see what's going on in there. First thing I would do, though, too, is making sure that your dog has a fecal checked and potentially treated for whipworms, because that's one of those things that we miss. So maybe a very easy fix.
All right. Thanks a lot for that call. And Sandy, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Always a pleasure. You're back August 30th.
I am. We've kind of switched to the end of the month now.
Well, yeah. that is wonderful. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine will be back on August 30th, so we'll look forward to that. Just take a look tomorrow at this time. We'll be talking about ATV and boating safety with some folks from the DNR. Hope you can join us. Stay with us. Meanwhile, lots in store here on the Ideas Network.